yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus, the show Alternative Visions. Well, today, we are going to turn to one of the most important grassroots movement in the U.S., the environmental movement. At the heart of that movement for a long time has been the Green Party USA. Okay? The environmental subject today has risen recently to the top of the national agenda, with last week's release by President Obama of the National Climate Assessment Report. It's a scary report. You better read it. My guest today, appropriately, to discuss the report and related issues is Jill Stein, who is the presidential candidate for the Green Party USA. Greetings, Jill. Are you there?
I am. Great to be with you, Chad.
Yes, as well. Well, we have a very important discussion here today. And let me just throw it out there for you, and you take it and give us, your view. The president released earlier this week an 841-page National Climate Assessment Report. I believe it's the second or third report ever issued. It's about climate change in the U.S. and general environmental issues in the U.S., and it pulls no punches. I mean, for a document coming out of Washington, it pretty much says we're in deep trouble here in the U.S., and folks may be experiencing some of that with these super storms, both in summer and winter, hurricanes and winter storms coming on in the East Coast. In the West Coast, we got this super drought and forests dying off. We've got evidence everywhere else from permafrost melting at record rates in Alaska, and maple syrup trees dying off in New England, and oysters in Washington, and all these things are talked about in the report, by the way, and there's a number of very good charts and evidence on this. The report's getting a full media court press by the administration. Let me ask you this, is this a cover aimed at environmentalist support for the November elections by Obama and the Democrats because they plan to approve the XL pipeline? What do you think? Am I too cynical about that?
Well, put it this way, it would be the perfect cover if they wanted cover. And, it certainly looks like they're going to approve that pipeline, although it's a wonderful, achievement of the climate movement that it's been able to delay that decision for several years. That's a great thing. But the southern half is built. The investments have been made. The trade agreements are there that make it very difficult to say no to the pipeline. I think many people expect the pipeline is going to be approved, and what a wonderful coincidence that this report is there to show that, the president in his heart and his administration care. However, to care but do nothing about it, or only fiddle around the margins, does not make it okay. And I think that this report, in some ways like the IPCC's report of a couple weeks ago, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the highest scientific body on climate change, in their report, they came out and yelled fire, but they came out with a squirt gun as to what exactly to do about that fire. And in many ways, this report does the same thing. It keeps us so busy looking at a sort of region-by-region, blow-by-blow assessment of how the climate crisis is going to roll out in a neighborhood near you or your very neighborhood. It keeps us very busy looking at that. And if it was, if one wanted to create a distraction, to distract from this question of what are you going to do about it, this would be the perfect distraction.
Well, yeah, that phrase, what are you going to do about it, I think is the crux of the issue here. And that is, you know, we talk about problems and talk incessantly, but we don't do very much about them. And I'm referring not just to the environmental issue, which is very pressing, but other economic issues as well. You know, we today still have, my estimates, about 20 million people unemployed. And I was asked recently to write an article on Obama's jobs program, and I said, well, there hasn't been any, you know, except for that silly thing called Jobs Now, you know, where it really was a break for tech companies with IPOs, and that was and nothing to do with jobs program, or putting GE CEO Jeff Immelt in charge of free trade, and that was called a jobs program. There really hasn't been any, and this seems to be a pattern, and now we see it in the environmental movement. A lot of talk about the problem, and yes, it's a positive thing to really describe the scope and the imminence of this environmental issue in the U.S., but where's the solution? What are you going to do about it? You know, that's the number one question. What are you going to do about this? And we don't see much, you know. I mean, there's not even a squirt gun here in the presidential report, like the IPCC, which, you know, there's some tepid proposals, but here there's virtually nothing as to what really needs to be done. So
exactly. And I think you're on the money, Jack, when you talk about, you know, the many problems. The environmental crisis, the climate crisis, does not exist in a vacuum. And it really goes hand in hand with the economic crisis, which is why, you know, in my view, in the view of the Green Party, you can't solve these problems independently. It's just not going to fly as a, you know, as a substantive matter. It requires a comprehensive solution. And as a strategic matter, you'll never get the critical mass to overcome, you know, the power that the 1% has right now without building a really broad-based mass movement. And as bad as the climate crisis is, the odds are, if you're an American, the struggle to keep food on your table and to keep a roof over your head and to get out of debt and to get your kids through school or higher education, give them any hope of a job, you have a disaster to deal with right now within 24 hours, whereas the climate crisis is always at least 24 hours away, you know, and maybe it's 10 years away. So, you know, I think in this country where the economic crisis is so severe, where one out of every two Americans, according to the Census Bureau, is either in poverty or low income, heading for poverty, where, you know, the minimum wage has profoundly declined over the last 40 years, where average wages have just barely held steady while the cost of living, you know, especially health care and education, have skyrocketed in housing. You know, that this is a divide and conquer situation that we're in, which is why, in my mind, the biggest environmental crisis and problem out there is actually the matter of jobs. It's the matter of jobs that solve the climate crisis at the same time that they provide living wages benefits and solve our economic crisis as well. Without that, we will never get up the head of steam that we need to actually fix this.
Well, you point to a couple of things that I'm, you know, very much concerned with, and that is it appears that so much of not just the environmental movement, but all these other issues, people are fighting back around single issues, and they've got to realize that these single issues have to come together in a general political movement and eventually a political party, perhaps the Green Party. You seem to be talking about all these issues, which is great to hear. The Green Party is not just about environmental issues, as I understand it, and that's great. But
exactly.
You know, we had a book published here just a week or so ago, Thomas Piketty's book called Capital, which is really about inequality, wealth and asset inequality. It's got a lot of traction. Paul Krugman, a liberal New York Times columnist, economist, is pushing it, and others are pushing it. But if you look at it, at the book and what Krugman and others have been talking about for a long time, it's just, let's change the tax system. I'm not against that. That's great. It's all lopsided in favor of the 1%, but what are the more fundamental problems causing the inequality? The tax system just allows it to mm-hmm. be carried through to, make sure the rich get their money, but it's not the cause. Mm-hmm. But that's so typical when you read Krugman and others, they talk about the problem, they give these safe solutions for members of the Democratic Party and their, and of course Republican Party and their big capitalist friends. Minimum wage is great, but what's it going to do for, tens of millions in the middle class and just below the middle class who are going backwards? Anyway, that's mm-hmm. just to draw a parallel to what you say here, that the single issue stuff and these tepid so safe solutions, you got to take these guys on, these guys meaning the 1% head on.
Exactly. And to tell you the truth, that's why I think we have an incredible window of opportunity right now, because it's a wake up moment, because the economic crisis is not being solved and because the climate crisis is not being solved. And increasingly people are waking up to that, especially young people who are taking it on the chin, on both of these dimensions, on unemployment, on debt, on the, impossibility of education and security, as well as inheriting, this ecological disaster in which increasingly the science points to 2050, if not before, as a time in which the basic foundations of civilization begin to unravel in terms of a food system that can actually feed us and provide affordable food, storms, and increasingly the threat of dramatic catastrophic sea level rise. And as you know, a report was just released in the past week, two reports, in fact, two absolutely impeccable scientific reports that both showed the impending breakup of a particular section of the West Antarctic ice sheet. That section alone will raise sea level by 10 feet, which is extremely shocking because it's essentially a closed for business sign over the cities of New York, Boston, Miami, New Orleans, and others as well. But those in particular, those cities are going to be devastated. And the real rub here is that this particular piece of ice sheet is only a poster child of what's coming, that you have really the West Antarctic ice sheet, and then you have Greenland, and I should mention you have the whole rest of the West Antarctic ice sheet, which goes far beyond 10 or 12 feet. The estimates I've read have been more on the order of 25 feet of sea level, plus another 25 feet of Greenland. So you quickly begin to render existing urban society and civilization obsolete. And of course that goes far beyond the geography of those particular cities. These are our ports, these are where we have where we exchange goods, where many forms of energy come in and out. Not to mention where many nuclear power plants exist, which will essentially be detonated by flooding or by severe drought and the other threats that climate change brings. So to get back to the point here, what we have really is, I think is a very clear picture now that we need a new paradigm, we need an emergency action plan to get there, that civilization as we know it ain't going to work, and that writing is not just on the wall, it's on the papers of, you know, the most reputable scientific bodies possible. Between sea level rise, death, killer heat waves, and agricultural collapse, we are not going forward, and the hammer is going to fall, you know, potentially 4 or 5 decades from now if we're lucky, but it could be sooner than that. So to my mind, this is the imperative we've been waiting for that says it's time for us to get together. They're not going to do it for us. We need a justice movement right now to solidify the numbers that we have, because we have the numbers, we have the blueprints, we have the plans. It's time for us to take ourselves seriously, to stand up, to get down to work right now with an emergency transition, a Green New Deal, if you will, that can put everyone back to work. That means, you know, 20 million jobs in this country and more than that around the world. It means getting to work right now, jump-starting the green economy, and making wars for oil obsolete, creating a healthy, resilient food system. And voila, you know, it means meeting our economic needs and meeting the climate emergency. We have no choice. So let's do it. Let's get together. The minute we get together, we're unstoppable.
Well, you know, there was another report this past week, too, that came out. Lots of reports here by the Pentagon itself that said this problem in environment and climate change is a national security issue now. Even, you know, the Pentagon and the military sees it. Well, what's the connection? It's very clear. It's that climate change is leading to water shortages and destruction of agriculture, and that's leading to more and more conflicts. In fact, most folks don't realize that the start of the Syrian conflict was over water. And look where that's led to, a civil war. And anyway, the military, U.S. military even, is aware that this matter is going to lead to more and more conflicts, including violent conflicts around the world as it continues to get worse. I don't think it's gonna take to 2050. I think 2030 is more likely the tipping point here in terms of the political effects of this climate change. You know, we're going through a historic drought here in the West, particularly in California. You know, if this continues for another couple of years, which is quite possible, folks think they're paying a lot for food now. You wait. And that means your standard of living is going to collapse even further as your debt rises here, Mr. Mm-hmm. Mrs. America, as your kids become even more indentured, trying to get an education and desperately keep themselves above water in terms of careers and income, and as jobs become more and more part-time temp jobs with no benefits and so forth, it's going to have a. I believe we're going to see this strong convergence between the climate and the environmental crisis and the economic crisis, both of which are developing largely in separate tracks now, but overlapping and coming closer and closer together. And, you know, if the fate of capitalist economies around the world is this sluggish no growth that will go on for years and perhaps decades, as the environmental crisis gets worse, the two crises here, the economy and the environment, are going to merge as never before. And I don't think they will have a solution to this. I really don't.
Well,
they meaning the policymakers. I don't see them. I see them trying to ignore it or put a finger on it. You know, finger in the dike and hope that either these things go away. But they won't go away. They might have been able to deal with one of these two major crises, but when the two overlap, then there's no solution forthcoming from those folks in Washington who are. Just the financial handmaidens of corporate America. You know, they're bought and owned, and they do whatever they're told to do. We lost our democracy and government some time ago.
Exactly. And, you know, there was a report that NASA put out a couple months back about one of the things that you just mentioned, that when you have a very dysfunctional set of policies, when you are overgrowing your resource base, your food or your water or your energy supply or your deforesting, you know, when you are dangerously undermining the foundations on which civilization exists, it's a grave threat to civilization. And in fact, Jared Diamond, the renowned anthropologist, author of Guns, Germs, and Steel, he makes the same point in his book called Collapse, which is essentially a study of civilizations that do and don't make it. And over the course of human history, we have quite a bit of experience there about when societies don't make it. And the prescription for collapse is overgrowing your resource base, but having a power structure that's incapable of experiencing that crisis and therefore fixing it. In other words, when you have an elite governing body, whether it's democracy or aristocracy, whatever it is, if it is insulated from the consequences of its own decision, that's a prescription for disaster. And that's exactly what we have right now, where you have such an elite, wealthy class that they're immune to the harm of their own policies. So it's no wonder that they're not fixing it. And if you look out there on the policy horizon, what are they proposing? You know, they're proposing absurd energy non-solutions, you know, like clean coal, allegedly, which is it's a fallacy. It doesn't exist.
Or an nuclear
power, which is...
It's an oxymoron term. Those are things
it
clean coal.
Is. Or the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is just going to send more jobs and further undermine wages and everything else, our democratic sovereignty and all the rest. So, you know, they are not going to fix it. That's absolutely clear. But what you were talking about our getting together, our convergence, I wanted to point out that this is actually ongoing right now. The convergence has been born. It has a website. In fact, there are several of them. But we just conducted a wonderful, exhilarating campaign from Earth Day to May Day to help connect the dots on the continuum of justice between Earth Day, the day of justice for the environment and the planet, and May Day, the day of justice for immigrants and for workers, and to say, hey, we all got to get out there together. And we put this idea out, and lo and behold, it just took off. You know, it just took off like horses out of the gate. And I would refer people to globalclimateconvergence.org. That's globalclimateconvergence.org. It is a transpartisan initiative. There are many Greens involved. There are also many socialists involved and independents. There aren't many corporate parties or advocates of corporate parties who are involved because, you know, we're talking about fundamental transformational reforms, which include reestablishing our democracy, getting money out of politics, taking back our rights of personhood from corporations who stole them from us, etc. But it's been so exhilarating to see this thing come together very quickly. And in my lifetime as an activist, this is totally new terrain, because for most of my lifetime, and I would expect yours, we've seen people very content to run in their own circles, you know, to stay inside of our silos. But I think we have come to the end of the road, and people are really seeing, you know, dedicated activists from labor, from environment, from anti-debt, from, you know, the right to education, you name it, from anti-TPP, for our civil liberties, for peace. In fact, the motto for this movement is people, planet, and peace over profit. It's about our coming together and recognizing that we are all up against the wall in this profit-driven system, and that we need a holistic and unifying strategy. We need all of us to get together. We need a strong movement out there in the streets and on the ground. We need to be working towards the global strike, which is what it's going to take. But as we build towards that, there is so much we can do. And in the meantime, we celebrate, we educate, and we agitate. And that's what we've been doing as we build our skills to work together. And at the same time that we lift up local fronts of struggle, and we lift up a whole variety of them, we also call for a unifying solution which is as big as the crisis that's barreling down on us. We are calling for an emergency transformational Green New Deal to put everyone back to work, to jumpstart the green economy, put a halt to climate change, and make these wars for oil and resources obsolete.
What would folks find if they go to the globalclimateconvergence.org site?
Well, first what you will find is a slideshow of what just happened. And it's absolutely staggering and beautiful, from species parades of endangered species or extinct species, to sort of get the point across, to sit-ins, to lockdowns, to solidarity marches. It's a magnificent profusion of this convergent movement. And
will they find things that they can do themselves or join in on this or that activity?
Yes. Absolutely. And at the moment, you can join in the discussion about where we go from here. You can sign up to be a part of the discussion in the little drop-down sign-up menu to become a part of the discussion. You can join our Thursday night in-person phone meetings, which are largely local organizers. And in the 2 months of run-up we had for this, just to give you a sense of how vibrant this movement is, hundreds and hundreds, about 800 people signed up. We had over 150 events organized in over 50 cities in the U.S. and as far away as Australia, New Zealand. We are transpartisan. We cross the borders of issues, and we cross the borders of nations to build a really consolidated movement. Our next big push is likely to be, and we're still having discussions about this, so we did Earth Day to May Day. There's interest in taking Independence Day, July 4th, and declaring it Interdependence Day, because as many of our organizers said, it just felt so good to repossess and reclaim our national holidays and transform them and infuse into them the vision of who we actually are and where we're actually going, and to sort of trump this kind of obsolete militaristic patriotism that surrounds so many of our national holidays. So there's Interdependence Day, but we're looking additionally at there's going to be a major climate summit in New York City in September. I believe the date is the 23rd. And surrounding those days, there's interest in creating an alternative climate summit to basically throw down the gauntlet and say, hey, UN, you know, and the whole COP process, this Conference on Parties, which was last, you know, held in Warsaw, where young people and indigenous people basically walked out because it's not done the job, and it's been co-opted by multinational corporations. So the idea is to say, we need our own movement. We need our own climate movement. And as a matter of fact, we need our own justice movement, comparable to what happened in the global south. You may recall there was a fight against the privatization of water, which was a very big deal for so many of the peasants and indigenous people who really live, you know, at the verge of oblivion, you know, not just poverty, but, you know, can they afford their day's water? So privatization of water was a huge big deal. It galvanized an enormous movement, particularly in Latin America. And at one point, that movement realized it wasn't going anywhere inside of the government, NGO, corporate process. It had to establish its own. So it stepped outside. It created an independent process that said, we're not negotiating about the price of water. We are declaring that water is a human right. And you know what? It's not the only human right. That we are going to establish a movement, a justice movement, for the rights of humanity and the rights of Mother Earth. And that's what it's about. And they went on to have revolutions then in Bolivia and Ecuador and establish those rights and, you know, make enormous leaps forward. So what we're kind of thinking here is, well, maybe we in the North need to be getting together and following in the footsteps of the justice movement of the Global South. Maybe we need a unifying global justice movement, not just for the North, but the whole thing, because when we get together for the big agenda, that's when we move. So that's what we're looking at in September. There will be other key events before then. We're looking at developing a community-based strike support committees so that we can begin to help workers who are striking, on whose actions we need to build, not only to achieve justice for workers, justice for our communities, but justice for climate. We need to be developing a unified movement here. So it's very exciting. Go to globalclimateconversion.org and become part of the action.
Well, you make a comment at the very end here, which I find very interesting, that the Green Party and others are attempting or considering community-based strike support committees. I've been running on this show, as listeners have obviously heard, a series of interviews with long-time experienced trade unionists, all of which have had 4 or 5 decades of experience. And the whole thrust of these interviews has been, is union labor at a strategic impasse? If you look at political strategy, industrial bargaining strategy, organizing, membership, and so on and so forth, the labor movement is on a slow decline to oblivion. And something really desperately needs to be done quickly, according to all my guests. And one thing we've been talking about, I and Staunton Lynn last week, in fact, talked about, well, the solution has to be organizational. Labor is not going to revitalize itself and resurrect itself unless there is a major organizational change, and that has to begin first at the local union level. And I've thrown out some ideas myself on my blog, jackrasmus.com, and my website, and also published them on several other public blogs about how to form a local mobilization committees as a new form of local union structure. Not replacing the current structure, but enhancing and adding to the current structure, both at the Central Labor Council level and the local unions in their various industrial stovepipes. But something where you could organizationally bring the most militant, best folks outside the union who are fighting for environmental change or for democracy in their communities, or all the other local community issues. The labor movement talks about, at the top, talks about labor community alliances, but doesn't do much about it. What we need is not to rely on these top leaders, but what we need is to get the best leaders locally in the labor movement together in some kind of permanent, emphasize, organizational form, where it's jointly led by the best people locally, and real actions are taken, not just to support strikes and boycotts on labor side, but real actions are taken to support the community alliance members as part of these local mobilization committees. So when you say strike support committee, right away my antenna went up and said, well, maybe we're talking something about the same thing. But, the main point is it's got to be something that's organizational and ongoing. If it's just ad hoc, it's going to rise and fall and disappear. Something more permanent has to come out of this organizationally, not just an ad hoc great idea. You support me, I'll support you. And I think the organization question is really key in front of us. Lots of folks know that something's wrong and everyone's getting screwed here, and we have all these single issues, but at some point, leaders of these, bona fide, vital single issue movements, whether it's environmental or others, have to come together in some sort of united effort movement, organizational as well, to that, so you can maintain continuity. Because right now, you know, the 1% does not have to divide and conquer. We've divided ourselves, and until we come together in a fist rather than finger by finger, you know, you can't fight back very well. Anyway, that's my my little contribution to this point that you actually bring up. And I find very interesting that the Green Party is thinking along those same lines as well. Now we have to come up with, you know, an idea here. And I think, too, that there has to be some sort of national convention of these bona fide movements to come together and develop a joint strategy and engage in joint tactics, or else... you know, we're going to go nowhere here.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, and I'm very excited to go take a look at your blog and your discussion about these local mobilization committees. And I do, you know, I really agree. I think this is so exciting that from, you know, from different corners of the activist movement, we're kind of coming to the same conclusion, that we need to work together, we need an infrastructure for that, and we need emergency action, and we need transformational strategies as well as, you know, transformational goals and solutions. So this is very exciting. I want to add to this, you know, that the justice movement of the Global South, which, you know, went on to transform the constitutions and the, you know, the modes of government in a couple of countries in Latin America, for starters. You know, they had such a conference, you know, they had a whole series of them, which grew out of these water conferences as they transformed from water conferences to justice conferences and to the right to water to a much broader set of human rights and rights of Mother Earth, that is, ecological rights. They, in 2007, they had a very important conference where they divided up into some, I don't know, 20 committees that all took a different piece of the problem and came up with statements that got back together in their big meeting in 2010. And at that point, they wrote the Cochabamba People's Accord, which is, you know, it's a wonderful document. It's worth a good look. And it, you know, essentially lays out a whole new paradigm that rejects the basic tenets of, you know, of modern predatory capitalism. You know, it rejects the concept of infinite growth. It rejects the concept of profit over people and over ecosystem. It establishes, you know, human rights, including human economic rights, as laid out by the United Nations in their Declaration of Human Rights. It establishes those rights to jobs and health care and education and all the rest. And along with that, it establishes the rights of ecosystems to exist and to maintain themselves as healthy living entities. So, you know, it absolutely makes the predatory economy that is devastating to our climate, our water and food supply and agriculture and all the rest, and to human beings, you know, it makes that predatory economy a thing of the past. And it's a wonderful, I think, living example of a direction that we should look at very seriously. And I completely agree with your call for such a conference. We're actually hoping that September, this global justice conference, could be a bit of a jumping off point. You have many of the big environmental groups as well as the environmental justice groups, the grassroots groups, that are looking to create a massive march to say it's time to change things. We, as the Global Climate Convergence, we're especially interested in the conversation and in the planning and in actually having a conference where we can sit down, where we can bring in particularly the frontline groups, that is, indigenous, immigrant, low-wage workers, unemployed, the poor, the anti-poverty movement, as well as climate and LGBT and women and the whole spectrum of those who are on the front lines of this struggle, the struggle for the economy, for our environment, for peace, and for democracy. They're all in there. We all need to sit down, get together, and divvy up what this new declaration of the rights of humanity and Mother Earth are. We have a great model to work from, and, you know, I would encourage anyone who's really interested in this concept, you know, please get in touch, and I would love to discuss it further with you, Jack. You know, if you have any interest in building on this September summit as a jumping-off point, because from my point of view, as long as it's a climate-only event or a climate-only movement, it's dead in the water. It needs to be a justice movement, and the sooner, in the same way that if it's a labor-only movement, it's dead in the water. We've come to the end of this road. It's time now to create our own road that will actually take us where we need to go.
Well, I absolutely agree with that idea. I would add the caveat, too, though, that whatever this conference is, it has to be comprised of movements, in other words, legitimate movements, people who represent legitimate movements. I'm not a big fan of intellectuals getting together in Chicago or someplace and declaring that they're a new party and a new movement and, you know, come join us kind of a thing. That's the wrong approach. I think it has to be people who are really engaged already in movements that are isolated from each other, but come together in a conference, maybe not September, but a follow-on, say, like at Cochabamba, you know, okay, you know, you're the water movement, you're the miners over here, and so forth. How can we support each other? How can we be a unified movement? And it sounds like, you know, they just said the term that's going to represent our unification is justice, the justice movement, which sounds great. But out of that has to come, you know, some sort of continual organizational structure and network. You know, one of the problems I think with Occupy was that it remained isolated city by city. It started coming together until the police came down on them. But, you know, pitching tents at City Hall is not a movement. It's an expression of discontent, but where do you go from there? There's got to be structure, there's got to be organization, there's got to be a unified strategy. That doesn't mean the single movements have to give up their single issues. No, you know, you can do both. It's not either or. You can continue your single movement, but within that you are part of a broader movement with the unified objectives and goals and organization as well. So, yeah, I would be glad to lend whatever support and see what happens. But if it's just another gathering of intellectuals who are above the real struggle in the real world and go home and they write their articles and that's the end of it, then I think we've seen too much of that too.
Oh, exactly. I couldn't agree more. You know, this is why I think it's really important that the frontline communities need to be there. Otherwise it's just, you know, it's an intellectual exercise, and we've had plenty of those. You know, I think the focus really needs to be on bringing, the leadership and the real grassroots vitality of the frontline grassroots movements, you know,
right,
and that is low-wage workers, you know, it's the indigenous movement.
Yeah, well, how about all these fast food workers, you know, striking across the country? Who's unifying that? You know, I mean, if the fast food workers who are really a convergence, represent a convergence of several problems, the very low pay, a lot of them are minorities, a lot of them are students, people who can only get part-time jobs, you know, and they're working for corporations that are billion dollars, corporations, 1% getting filthy rich, you know, the Waltons and all that stuff, McDonald's, etc., you know. it's a convergence, but who's going to organize them? Are we going to organize them in the same old way? Is the food and commercial workers, you know, going to organize them and try to get contracts with McDonald's and stuff like that? As I've pointed out, you don't have to sign a contract to have a contract that gives you higher wages and benefits. In other words, you can enforce an agreement with your employers without having to sign a contract. And maybe we ought to think in the labor world more about that old form that we had, you know, in times past, which means you got to have a vibrant movement ongoing at all times to enforce that contract. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's another thought.
Mm-hmm.
That we should consider. We need a movement to enforce it, not a legal piece of paper to enforce it.
Exactly, and that holds true across the board, you know, in terms of, you know, defending our civil liberties or stopping, you know, this rush to war over Ukraine, you know, the Third World War, you know, engaging Russia, you know, that Obama seems to be hell-bent on doing. You know, we need to have a movement that's, you know, that's capable of flexing its muscle in the street. We don't have that now. Under Richard Nixon, you know, one of the most regressive presidents ever, you know, we had real forward motion and brought troops home from Vietnam and achieved real movement for women's reproductive rights and for clean air and clean water. You know, we did that by getting out and flexing our muscle. And that's all been taken away from us. You know, we don't
yeah,
have that
what, hope of what, once the union movement and all other, you know, the environmental movement in times past and others said, okay, we're going to have a strategy of just trying to lobby the Democratic Party. That was the kiss of death. That was the end, you know, and we see the results after three decades of that strategy of let's be an interest group on the fringe of the Democratic Party, get you absolutely nothing in the long run. So, yes, I'm all for that, but we really need to come together, I believe, and I really like some of the work that you're doing, and I really like your message. I mean, you're saying the same thing, really, that it's time to come together, folks. If we're going to do something, just not talk like the president's report about the problem anymore, but actually doing something, and don't think you're going to lobby those dinosaurs in Congress who are owned, bought, and controlled totally, all of them, as far as I'm concerned, by business interests. Don't think they're going to do anything for you on your behalf.
Exactly. And we both need to come together. We need to flex our muscle. And I think, you know, we need a very clear agenda because, you know, one of the benefits of the climate emergency is that it says we got about 15 years. You know, even the IPCC said that much. We have 15 years to fundamentally change the program. So, you know, we are calling explicitly, as part of this convergence, we are calling very specifically for a solution as big as the crisis barreling down on us. So that means we are calling for an emergency jobs program. We are calling for living wages. We are calling for health care as a human right under a Medicare for All system. We are calling for massive demilitarization. We are calling for education as a human right, forgiving student debt. We're calling for forgiving third world debt, for that matter, as well. We're calling for, you know, the wealthy nations of the North to basically pay our due and ensure that this transition to 100% clean renewable energy, wind, water, and sun, happens by 2030, and that it happens all over the planet, and that we benefit enormously by ensuring we have a livable planet. So we who got the money are going to foot the bill. So we are very explicit. We're not just having a kumbaya moment to feel good about coming together. We're coming together to fight peacefully, but it is a fight. It won't happen without an enormous wrestling match over this, and we're prepared to do that and to come together and to stick together to implement this plan.
Well, you know, let me throw this at you, too. Over half of the global greenhouse gas emissions, well over half, comes from two countries, the U.S. and China, right? It's very difficult to get 180 nations to agree on programs that would be global. You know, the U.S. and China could together start the whole process. Maybe we ought to be leveling some demands on both U.S. and China as the two joint culprits for the problem. You know, 80% of all the emissions come from oil, gas, and cement in the world, and 20% mostly from deforestation burning, which is located primarily in South America, Brazil, and Indonesia, and a few other places. But it's mostly oil, gas, and cement problems, and most of that is, you know, coming out of China and the United States. So maybe we ought to point fingers at these two big culprits and say, look, you're the biggest source of the problem. You got to start first, and this is what you got to do, X, Y, Z, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know. What do you think of that idea?
You know, absolutely, and I think that can go hand in hand. But if the U.S. alone, because it's one thing to look at national emissions, it's another to look at per capita. And in many ways, it makes a lot of sense to look at per capita emissions. That is, you know, per person. China has a lot of people. Just the way their national boundaries are drawn, they have an awful lot of people. But if you're looking at the per person use of energy, which is really the operative unit, that's really where waste and excess occurs. It's in the, and I don't just mean the family, you know, it's, this is all sort of, you know, statistically normalized per person. It's really the business interest. It's the 1%. I mean, there's another statistic for you, that about half of all energy use is coming from the wealthiest 1%. Now, many of that is through corporate, you know, endeavors, but look at what corporations are endeavoring to do. The most incredibly wasteful, you know, ridiculous, you know, casinos and enormous dams and, you know, massive military installations. This is where our energy use is really going, you know, the things that are most destructive to all of us. So, you know, it just benefits everybody and the everyday people of the world in such a big way to absolutely rein in those emissions, to drastically cut them on an emergency basis. This is a good thing, and it changes, you know, it requires us to change our transportation systems and our food systems and our energy. But the wonderful thing is, in doing that, we have a jobs program to put everybody back to work. And not only that, this is the really good news piece of this. Making those changes has a profound benefit on our health. And this is where we get together with the people of China, you know, who are paying with their lives and their health for the, you know, for the fossil fuel excesses of China as well. They don't need coal plants, you know. China has the capacity to build wind and solar, and they're already way ahead of the game on solar. So, you know, they can be, you know, I think without a whole lot of trouble. Put it this way, if we can get the U.S. to do the right thing, we can get the people of the world to, you know, to push the envelope in countries all over the world. And when we do that, our health benefits so much that the savings in sick care are enough to pay for the cost of the transition. This is a wonderful study that came out of Stanford University by environmental engineer, Mark Jacobson, in the last 2 years or so. And what that study showed, it looked at New York as a case study. It looked at what would it cost, what would it take to achieve 100% wind, water, and sun by the year 2030. And what he found was that we would benefit so much from the prevention of cancers and asthma and heart attacks and strokes and all these terrible diseases that are tied very directly to fossil fuel pollution. We would benefit so much that the savings in health care alone are more than enough to pay for the cost of the energy transition. So this is a good news scenario. It's all around good news. And I think the name of the game is our deciding that this is the way forward, and we're not going to settle for anything less as working people, you know, and as communities. Nobody pays a bigger price than working people for the toxicity of fossil fuel. On the job, workers in the fossil fuel industry have a 700% increased chance of dying from the acute, immediate health risks of working with fossil fuels. And then there's a much longer term risk that hasn't been really documented for, you know, the diseases that they will incur, heart attacks and strokes and cancers and all of that, just from accidents on the job.
But, you know, I really like your idea of green jobs, and I think we need to flesh that out even more than the call for green jobs. In other words, exactly what jobs and how. You know, historically, you can look at the Depression in the 1930s, when we created the Works Progress Administration. You know, the total size of the workforce back then was about 40 million. 8 million people went through the Works Progress Administration at some point. You know, almost one in five, had a government job. And these weren't minimum wage jobs. And these were all kinds of jobs. And there were quotas, of who would get the jobs geographically and by other criteria and so forth, you know. And it saved the country from collapse because people finally had an income. Well, today we have nearly 160 million people. If we had something similar to the Works Progress Administration, in other words, a real jobs program, you know, that would be 30 million people, you know, and we could have that in urban green works jobs administration. In other words, clean up our cities and the infrastructure. There's a, you know, you don't have to go to the countryside as they did in the 30s in many cases with the Civilian Conservation Corps. The work is there to be done in the urban, in the city areas, and much of that could be green conversion jobs of all kinds. That really needs to be defined in greater detail using that historic experience and showing how that success could be replicated to do something about the dual problem of the economic problem, the heart of which is no jobs or poor jobs, underpaid jobs, and the growing climate problem, both of which I've said are converging in like never before. So, you know, I guess that's a topic for this conference,
maybe. That's a great idea. Very exciting. Yeah.
We need to put some flesh on the bones of this idea of we need to come together. Okay, we're going to come together. What are we going to demand? What are our issues? What are our objectives for each demand? And then what's this joint strategy we're going to employ to try to get from here to there? It's like an old-fashioned union organizing campaign. You know, you got to say, okay, folks, we're going to get a union. Our objective, what do we want? How are we going to do it? X, Y, Z. You know?
I love it.
Okay. Well, I think we got a signal here that we got to leave. But, you know, I want to thank you, Jill, for coming on and telling us all this interesting stuff. And once again, folks, globalclimateconvergence.org. Any other source we should tell the listeners to go to if they want to get involved?
You know, you can also go to your state Green Party site, or you can go to System Change, Not Climate Change.
Okay, System Change.
Out there.
Climate Change. All right. We're getting a strong signal here, so I guess we got to go. Anyway, folks, join me next week on this show, and we will talk about the Eurozone. Back to the economy. Is the Eurozone really recovering, or is it really a false recovery? And what's happening financially, and what's happening to real folks in the Eurozone? This is Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions. Talk to you again.
Thanks, Jack. Good talking.
Thank you for coming, Jill.
Sure thing.